Looking for a job isn't easy. It used to be that you could apply at a big name tech company and build a great career for yourself. But times have changed. Many of these companies have gone full woke. And if you aren't the right gender, ethnicity, you don't use pronouns, or if you're not an activist for the preferred cause, then good luck. Why would you risk your career on that? At Red Balloon, we're connecting good employees with top quality companies that value you for your skills and your work ethic, not your social activism score. Employers who post jobs on Red Balloon are focused on creating an enjoyable and productive work culture, free from divisive woke mandates. So if you want to find a serious career path without the nonsense, come to Red Balloon and post your resume today. Because you shouldn't have to choose between your job and your values. That's redballoon.work, where you can find your future.
Just as the father goes, so goes the household. Often, as the leaders of the nation go, so goes the nation, right? And so we have to build a base, but we also need to pray that God would raise up, you know, our Joseph, our Daniel, these, think about even Luther. You know, Luther really had the backing of powerful people and their money. And so there is a balance. We have to build this foundation and then look for support, the pastors, the leaders, the politicians, that the few that are good, and support them. And that's kind of the two-front war that we're fighting.
Hey everyone, Michael Thiessen here. You are listening to Open Mic with Michael Thiessen, and today I have the privilege of having Pastor Michael Foster on with me. Mike, we're going to let you get into some of the content work you've been doing, but just before we do that, I want to remind everybody that this show is produced by Liberty Coalition Canada in partnership with ChristianWeek.org. Liberty Coalition Canada exists to establish Christ's justice and righteousness and to defend those who stand. And Christian Week exists to provide a practical, balanced, hope-filled perspective on national and global issues. So for our Canadian listeners, Michael Foster is a pastor in Batavia, Ohio. I guess that's for our American listeners too, Mike. But we're having a conversation today about some important subject matter: manhood, boys, men, family. Of course, we are in the middle of Pride Comes Before the Fall month, as our good friend Andrew DiBartolo likes to call it. And so this is a timely conversation, Michael. So thank you for being on the show.
Yeah, glad to be here. Thanks for making some time for me.
So let's talk about your projects. Your first project that is maybe on your end of things as far as your work coming to completion is It's Good to Be a Man. Michael, both of my boys have read your book, and now you've just made It's Good to Be a Man documentary. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yeah, it started about, believe it or not, almost 5 years ago now. So I wanted to do a podcast on biblical sexuality. And I started researching and thinking about how to make it something that's not just a retread of other content out there. While that was happening, there's kind of the explosion of red pill sexuality or the manosphere or just all this sort of conversation about men's rights, pickup artistry, men's movements of one sort or another were blowing up on the sort of secular stage. It's even bigger now, but maybe blowing up is it got on the radar, and I saw it and I started listening. Guys like Jordan Peterson were really coming into their own around that time, and had a lot of Christians friends that were listening to them, and I wanted to know why Christian men were listening to all these non-Christians, you know. And so I started to digest some of that content out of a desire to understand why they're turning there instead of the church. And it just became clear that these guys were teaching a lot of really practical stuff. And it wasn't all right. It was a mixed bag: evolutionary psychology, you know, Jungian psychology, just hedonism, some evil stuff. But they had found some what I would call creational patterns, right? Just things that are from God's design. And they were speaking to them and giving guys some steps to take, to take responsibility for themselves, to pursue various types of excellence, that to recognize that women aren't men. And there's a different way to approach a woman than a man. So I started to see how all that stuff was, why it was popular with those young men. And, but again, it was kind of mixed up. It was a mixed bag. So I thought I would start to speak to those issues from a biblical framework and both say this part's right, but this part's wrong, you know? And so I started that. I just started a little Facebook page called It's Good to Be a Man. I did that because I wanted to focus on kind of positive sexuality. A lot of times these conversations on sexuality all become about what women can't do as opposed to what a man is and what a man should be. And then we get kind of bogged down in the conversation that has kind of been a cul-de-sac going nowhere. So I wanted to talk about the goodness of the male sex. God designed us. He made us male and female in his image, right? So there's a binary to mankind, which is male and female. And I wanted to focus on the male part. It's funny that people thought I was trying to be provocative with that title. I actually wasn't. I was trying to do the opposite. I was just trying to say, like, let's talk about the goodness stuff. So then pretty early on, I became friends with a guy named Non Tenet. And I said, hey, you seem to be thinking about some of these things. Why don't you partner up and we'll create more content and we'll start a podcast and see if we can't really create a book. So we did 75 episodes together. Originally, we had kind of this grand scheme of writing a male systematic theology, right? Like a systematic theology on sexuality. But it became much more practical and pastoral over time. And I always call it a project because I didn't really want to start a nonprofit ministry or anything like that. And I'm not super keen on being a conference speaker or anything like that. So I called it a project because I knew it'd have an end. And so really it's come to an end. And it all fit well. We hit 75 episodes. The last episode was about the death of my brother and him being weighed down by regret and nostalgia and kind of a call to get out of the dark valleys and move forward and build something positive. So I felt like, while that's not the way I planned it to end the podcast, I thought that was a strong way to end it. And then we had this, you know, documentary that Canon approached me about that we filmed over about a year's time. And that came out here, I guess, like 2 months ago. And it seems like it's done very well. I've gotten a lot of good comments on it, but it was kind of a focused in on some really practical parts for young men taking responsibility for themselves. So it wasn't like the whole book, because why recreate the whole book as a documentary, but focusing in on that part. And it's only like 50 minutes long, but I think we packed a lot into it. So it's been a fun ride, and it's been cool to be part of these conversations and be able to help people.
Hey friends, I'm happy to talk to you again about RockLink Investment Partners. With inflation at 40-year highs and economic stagflation on the horizon, growing and preserving your hard-earned capital is of utmost importance. I know it's on my mind. And that's why RockLink Investment Partners are so essential, because they understand the investment challenges of today. RockLink is an independent investment management firm focused solely on creating portfolios of high-quality businesses anchored to the time-tested principles of value investing. And they do not shy away from essential businesses that do not meet the World Economics Forum's definition of ESG. So email RockLink at info@rocklink.com. That's RockLink with a C. Or visit them at www.rocklink.com. And again, that's Link with a C.
You know, in the beginning moments of the trailer, you basically make an allusion to, you know, you can be talking to an extreme leftist or you can be talking to a conservative right, and everybody is saying, you know, men are struggling. There's a book out by Richard Reeves called Of Boys and Men, Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters and What to Do About It. And it's a really he's not very helpful when it comes down to in any way acknowledging God's creational norms and God's purposes for men. But it's a tale of interventionism and affirmative action only harming rather than helping. So, you know, if you feel like women are for some reason oppressed by men, and so you're falling into the trap of the battle of the sexes rather than the battle for the sexes, you know, he's now documenting how attacking men doesn't actually help women. It just attacks men and hurts men. And so the I find it a fascinating read. When he gets to the end of the book, for me, it's a big duh. You know, the final chapter of his book is, you know, what are we going to do about it? He says, you know, we need more male teachers, duh. Let's talk and more shop, duh. And dads matter. And I'll give him credit for, you know, saying some of those things out loud, but it's fairly weak because, you know, here's a guy who's deeply seeped in critical theory and feminism, and he just can't say the words, it's good to be a man and we shouldn't attack them. So I do want to acknowledge, Michael, that I appreciated the title of your book. I do appreciate the good nature of it. It's also, you know, it's a creational statement. God created them good, very good. People might have been thinking you're provocative because the assumed cultural moment is it's bad to be a man. Mm-hmm. So I just really appreciated the way you framed the whole conversation. Here's a question for you. Where do we go in this world of activism now where you're going to want to have authors like Richard Reeves saying, no, the solution is affirmative action back in the institutions. The solution is redshirting men, starting them a year behind schedule. It is still steeped in major psychological analysis of the situation rather than God's word. Where do you see kind of some of the, maybe I want to say institutional solutions coming, some practical thoughts for institutions that are trying to consider some of the points that you're making, maybe more from an institutional framework rather than an individual family framework?
Well, the big problem that we have right now is no one understands what households are. So think about this. One reason you could rapidly plant churches in the book of Acts, and Paul did, he planted them very quick. there's a book called Missionary Methods by Roland Allen. And he goes through and shows just like, we're talking churches are starting within months, they're being planted and up and running. Whereas, you know, from my world of Presbyterianism, it takes years to get a church, you know, planted. And that's because there's always sort of speed versus security, right? The quicker you plant a church, the less prepared a lot of times. But what's interesting is the reason those churches could start so quick is because they were based in functioning households. These are households that had property, they had influence, they had patterns and rhythms. And when you plant a church, what you want is really stable families. That's what makes a church kind of have the core it needs. And that's really true of all society, is the problem that households are now just houses, right? They're places to hang out. They're not places of productivity. They're not a place where you gather assets and influence and all that. They're not stable. And I think helping reclaim a vision of a greater purpose to marriage than just individual pleasure, and even companionship, but it is literally producing households that are these centers of productivity, of creation. That because institutions are going to depend on that. You can't build the institution of the church, the government, society, all those depend on functioning in households. And the campaign to destroy marriage and fatherhood and fruitfulness has destroyed the household. It was already in trouble as we were losing ourselves due to the Industrial Revolution. Not that the Industrial Revolution's bad. It just redefined the household in a way that has been causing trouble. And then comes feminism. So I think helping people understand that you should have you should be owners, right, and not renters in this world, that your home should be a place where you have lots of things and do lots of things. And any institution that can help people set that up, whether they're teaching them how to practice family religion or you're teaching them how to create, you know, revenue producing assets, all that sort of stuff. That's what leads, like, people. You need money. You need money to get things done, right? You need money to build stuff. And money comes from the stable homes, you know?
I think that that's a good point. And something that I think that is evident in the numbers is that when a lot of the feminist accounting for what they would call inequality would be more just the prioritizing of the household. So yes, you can look at stats and you can say, you know, a woman in her mid 30s makes less than the same, you know, male educated, same job experience, but they usually fail to pull out of the numbers in those situations. Well, she's taken a significant time off to have children. And so the numbers are immediately skewed and the household is discarded. It's not recognized as, well, of course, like, you know, when we want thriving homes, we need a mother at home taking care of children and a husband providing. And that is going to cause the numbers you're looking at to be different in the workplace. And that's not a bad thing. Why? Because we prioritize the household. And so I think that you're absolutely right. You know, we know that within the cultural Marxist framework, one of the priorities is to destabilize the home so that then property and personal cachet, all of those things are leave the family, you know, transferring that wealth to the state as much as possible, transferring that education to the state, transferring all of those things to other operators so that the home isn't strong and protected. So I appreciate that answer, Michael, because I think when I asked the question about institutionalization, it's, you know, targeting, you know, new Christian institutions. What are we going to do about education? What are we going to do about targeting men and women for their vocational aspirations? And the number one solution is we need to have a, you know, a deep, rich theology and orthopraxy of the home. I don't know about you. Maybe you can comment on this, but I know that one of the greatest joys of pastoring and one of the most, you know, we've just cracked all of the light bulbs, put them out on the floor, and we're walking across the glass as pastors is when a young woman says, well, what should I do with my life? And you're thinking in your mind, well, I need to help her and her parents prioritize the home. But you have this really great cultural moment of, okay, but we're walking on eggshells. We're walking on broken glass here. So I'm just going to venture out and try not to get too cut.
Yeah, I think teaching. So the thing with the household is, and you kind of made this point, authority works a lot like energy in a sense. So you have the conservation of energy. Energy is neither created nor destroyed. Now, as Christians, we'd say God created energy, and now in the world he made, in the creation, it's neither, like, there's not new energy and it's not destroyed. It's conserved. Authority is kind of the same way. God has delegated authority into the world to three institutions, the home, the state, the church. And that authority has a domain and limitations, a boundary, and they overlap to some degree. But when any institution fails to do their job, so one, like the job of the government is to punish evil and praise the good. So if the government is not punishing evil, well, then someone else, that's where you get vigilantes, right? And so basically heads of households have to take up that sort of defense. And so it's not done through the magistrate. If a father fails to discipline his child and raise him up in a way that is conducive to society, behavior in society, and he becomes, you know, immoral and criminal, well, then who has to get involved? Well, the state has to get involved. When what we've had happen is the household has been eviscerated, and now it's anemic. They took everything out of it. We took production out of it, so we're not doing business there anymore. We took education out of it. Then the dining rooms got smaller and smaller, and we took hospitality out of it. And it's not a place for fellowship often. So there's, again, that sort of interpersonal fellowships out of it. And the household wasn't a robust place of authority anymore. And the government ate that all up, especially as fathers abdicated. And now we have this nanny state that has all this power and all this authority because we allowed them to take it. We gave it over to them. They didn't come and take it by a gun. We submitted it to them and surrendered it to them. And now they have so much power, they're hard to overcome and resist. And so a tyrannical state will always be wary about strong households, because if there's enough of them, and they actually pose a threat to, like, for example, there's still more money in the American upper middle class or middle class than there is in the 1% of the Americans. There's still more power. So they have a lot of power. One of the things that the pandemic probably was used to do by the social engineers was to hurt the middle class by shutting down small businesses. And then there's a redistribution of wealth to match also the redistribution of authority and to weaken households, because the people that have a lot of power are these folks that are successful business owners that are upper middle class. And some of them are, you know, actually rich, but not one percentile rich. Like what people understand is Americans are the 1% compared to the rest of the world. And then the 1% of the Americans is like a whole another level. That's why I think if we can get households out of debt, producing assets, not losing their kids to the culture, creating a holy culture, and men that are, you know, strong and confident, then we have a chance to really push back on the tyranny we see. And then those households can join together with the cumulative nature of their wealth and all that, and they can start to build schools, and they can start to, or at least finance the schools. They don't have to be the ones that build it, but how many people have tried to start like some sort of Christian school, and there just was not the demand for it yet, and there wasn't the money to support it. And so we have to, we're doing lots of things all at once. Like my big goal is to create kind of a sanctuary city. I thought, find a place where you could have influence. If the whole world blew apart, you could kind of build an island there if you had to, right, to the best of your ability. And so I landed on Batavia because it's the county seat in a county adjacent to Hamilton County, which is where Cincinnati is. And Cincinnati is what swings the state towards conservative votes. And so a lot of people leave the city and live out in the suburbs in the country. And we have a lot of that out here in Batavia. So if we could have influence in the county seat, and then that spread to the whole county, then we could influence Cincinnati, which influenced the state, which influences the entire country, right? And but the place it had to start with wasn't, like, I had all these guys back in early 2020 telling me the food supply is about to disappear. What have you done for, like, the supply chain? How are you going to fix it? And I was like, I've done nothing. Like, my family, we bought a bunch of stuff. Right. And we keep reserves and all this stuff. You know, I've got 2 refrigerators, 3 deep freezes, like 2 dry pantries. I got chickens, you know, I got stuff. But I thought, you know, I didn't want to sow fear and get this sort of rushed panic. I thought was more important. I remember telling this guy, like, we don't even have membership and official elders at East River yet. My priority is to set up a strong church that creates the community, that creates the fabric that would support people through hard times, right? If you don't have that, you don't have anything. And so I ignored, you know, I don't know how long we've almost ran out of diesel fuel. Everyone tells us diesel fuel's going to be gone, you know, in a week. That's been going on for like 2.5 years now, and it hasn't happened. I don't know why. There might be some answer for it, but it still hasn't happened. And so you always have these people that want to get you to focus on urgent things. Sometimes they actually are urgent, but many times they aren't. And you just have to be polite and kind of stick to your mission. And my mission was to establish a strong church, then get involved in the businesses in my county, and then see institutions like schools started and then get people involved in government. And that's exactly what we're doing. You know, I've launched a business out here, and now we've got a school starting, but the basis of it were these households that we're drawing in and building up.
One of the things when we decided to get involved with home education and, you know, Christian classical education, one of the things when our church got involved with really calling men to be producers and to see themselves as, you know, I call the men of our church he warriors and the women of our church she warriors, because we're at a cultural moment where people are talking about things they've never talked about before. They're seeing, you know, the pandemic just ripped the mask off of evil, and people saw human depravity for what it is in many respects. But even, you know, when we call the household to rise up with all of the things that you've just talked about, so natural. Like if you take these things, maybe without using any labels, without using any Christianese language, if you were just to go out and kind of talk to people about raising children who are virtuous and competent, or you talk about, you know, women deeply satisfied in their relationships, men, you know, thriving and you know, contributing to the community, for example, and all of these things, people will give you, you know, a soft applause. And then when you actually put on the strength and the theology and the foundation of why you would want to do all of those things in the context of Christianity, because the household is a beautiful place to produce for the kingdom, you can see easily when now people understand all of the why, you can see why men are so attacked. You could see why that would be an absolute strategy of Satan himself and his minions to attack men. Because if you make men immobile, according to the creational standards, he's the leader of the home. And if you debilitate him, then you cripple the entire household. And so I'm glad you started with the concept of it's good to be a man. I know you've moved on to another project, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. But really, being a man is far more elaborate than I think. You know, being a household is far more systematic. It's far more holistic. When we got into all of this, we realized, you know, almost everything needs to change. You can't have a certain view on education and still create a great household. You can't have a maybe a weak view of motherhood and have a strong household. You can't not call men to be he warriors if you can't not do that and still have strong households. It's the whole thing. I don't know if you feel like that as a pastor, but the more you kind of, you know, unravel the onion, you realize, wow, you know, God's created us to do this systematically, very practically, as you mentioned earlier. And when we get out of just some of those simple habits, we can really derail quickly.
Yeah, 100%. I think everything flows from the household, really. That's where it all started. And that's, if we want to reclaim these things, that's what we have to focus on right now. We have to build it up. If we don't have a strong base to work from, there's no winning. People want to start from top down, and there's something to that. There is a place for that. I used to be kind of this, you know, only bottom up sort of blue collar, proud sort of guy, right? It was just out of a dislike, distrust of elites. However, God through history has worked through elites quite a bit, through kings that have changed the direction of their nation. And just as the father goes, so goes the household. Often as the leaders of the nation go, so goes the nation, right? And so we have to build a base, but we also need to pray that God would raise up, you know, our Joseph, our Daniel, these, if you think about even Luther. You know, Luther really had the backing of powerful people and their money. And so there is a balance. We have to build this foundation and then look for support, the pastors, the leaders, the politicians, that the few that are good, and support them. And that's kind of the two front war that we're fighting.
In both cases, it takes courage and it takes godly men to have a backbone. You know, I'm thinking of, you know, you named a few kings, like we've got Constantine, we've got Justinian, we've got Alfred the Great. We've got Cromwell. We've got, you know, so many different examples of where, bold men led a nation back to, a law that would restrain the people from evil and introduce people to the gospel. You know, we think about, you know, all, you know, a number of the Christian foundations for education. You know, you mentioned Luther. Luther's got a great, he's got a great article to the councilman of why every German councilman needs to establish schools or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, if you own his Luther's works, it's a quick Google, you'll find that it's there. And he develops a whole, you know, theology of education. It's really powerful. In fact, ironically, he's a bit inconsistent in it. He says, you know, really God gave this to the parents, but we know that they won't do the job, so we've got to start German schools. I think that's the only place where Luther chooses to be a pragmatist pastor rather than but we all make mistakes. Like Luther's good, but he's not perfect. Mm-hmm. This has been a good conversation, Michael. Maybe not everybody knows, but while we landed in the United States, our family attended Michael's church for about 4 months. And we appreciate y'all up in Batavia so much, your hospitality to us. And it's true. You know, you're pretty, I want to say, basic isn't the word I'm looking for, but maybe foundational. You know, it's a really rich liturgy, but it's not opulent in any way. There's no pomp to it. You're very consistent, but you try very hard every week for that consistency to be met with like human practical interaction with what you're teaching. Your sermons have always, you know, they're an encouragement. I always sit back and go, I love how he's just in the text, man. How rare it is to have guys in the text and just explain the text simply and then apply it to the real world. Like that's a major problem in our churches.
Yep.
So,
They don't know how to read. People don't know how to read the Bible. And one of the best things you can do to teach people how to read is to, just do exegesis in front of them. So one, you teach them how to read, and then you teach them how to apply. And there, I try to hit huge portions of scripture, and I don't usually get too deep into one area of it for too long, because I want them to see how these things work and how they're connected, and teach them how to read and think. And so I'm not going to be one of those Reformed churches for a long time where, look, we're going to do a deep dive in Romans for 5 years. That's not where we're at yet. We have a lot of people that are from a non-Reformed background, haven't been theologically educated or anything like that. So it's super important that we get them familiar with the basic concepts in Scripture, the basic theology, and we'll lay a foundation. And then, you know, maybe we'll be able to do one of those really, you know, I really want to go through books like Ezekiel and stuff like that, that most people don't do. But we gotta do our work and we get these people established and thinking covenantally and all that sort of stuff. And then we'll be able to build on it. But yeah, we definitely try to stay as accessible as possible without doing injury to the text and being condescending.
Yeah. And accessible as possible is a really good way to phrase it. Cause I appreciate even the liturgy of the church and yet how interactive it is. It's not just something that's read and recited. It's something that's interacted. I appreciate it when you and John reference the catechisms or the confessions. You know, there's a historical drawing forward. And I think the purpose of that is so that, again, the household can mimic some of that. The household can go and learn how to interact, you know, interact with prayers at home, you know, so things don't just become monotonous or just rot memory that's useless. So I appreciate the example at the church and anybody, if you're in the, you know, in Michael's area and you're looking for a good church, we really appreciated our time at East River and Lord willing, our ongoing partnership, because we're only about an hour and 15 minutes away from you guys. And we look forward to that as we walk forward in our new journey here in the great US of A. And maybe you and I, maybe one of your next projects you can help me do a sitcom called USA, and it's like a Canadian A. And sure. You can mock all of the new Canadian friends that you have down living in the US and we can try to raise the bar of our Americans.
You guys are, you're the rare fighting Canadians. So most of us Americans think of Canadians just as these super nice guys that are polite and everything. And so you guys are still pretty polite, but you're willing to fight your crazy prime minister up there. So that was beautiful.
Well, and the reality is, you know, when we're talking about this, you just saw how much socialism had impacted Christians, how very few Christians do understand some of the things that you and I are talking about. We're talking about sphere sovereignty. The government gets to do certain things. It doesn't get to do all things, and it's not needed to do. And how weak the family really is. I think that's one of the things that was revealed significantly, that one of the doctrinal errors, one of the crafty human ideas that has been sold very convincingly to Christians in Canada is that socialism works. You know, I still kind of take a second take here when I hear Americans talk about, you know, wanting socialized medicine or, government funded healthcare, and you just start telling them about some of the wait times and some of the situations that, you know, in Canada, you know, if you don't go along with the government's line, you can actually be put to the end of the line in certain situations. So, we're kind of here to help warn Americans. Don't go down that road, and specifically Christian Americans, keep up in this cultural moment, because like you said, it's a both and battle. We have to build the institution of the family, but there is a cultural talking point going on right now. I'm sure you're seeing it everywhere. You know, it can be Christian nationalism, it can be labeled whatever that you want to see it, but in the United States there is a good healthy discourse of we don't want the ideology of the left. What do we do? And I'm excited to be here and to be a part of it. So, but no, let's not go down that road. Let's go on to your next project. And we might have already talked enough about the content of it, but what are you and your wife working on now?
Well, it's kind of what we've been talking about, like you said there. So we started a website and a podcast called WeMadePeople.com. And kind of like It's Good to Be a Man was, I came up with that from jogging. I when I would jog, I would run 2 miles. And there's this house that their mailbox was my turning point. I'd run to it. That was about a mile, and then turn back around and run a mile home. And the mailbox was, it was the Goodman's house. So I was like, every time I get to it, I'd just say, yeah, it's good to be a man. Keep going. And that's where that name came from.
I'm laughing because if you thought of It's Good to Be a Man while you were jogging, my mind immediately went to what were you doing when you came up with the title We Made People?
That's what I'm about to say. We weren't making people, but we were sitting on the we were sitting somewhere watching all our kids do something, and I just remember saying, "Man, look at all the people we made." And I was like, "That's cool. We made people." That kind of rolls off the tongue and is short, and I bet no one else thought about it. And so what we wanted to do is a podcast, a marriage, family, household podcast that's framed around the children that we had, because our marriage almost fell apart about 2 years in because we had just lost our focus and we weren't having children. We were kind of falling into the careerist path, of life. And Em was a nurse and I was doing all sorts of crazy things back then. And, we're pulling away. And then we recognized that we had kind of departed from the direction we had been on, which was a much more patriarchal fruitfulness, having children. We had a high value and all that when we were dating. And then we just kind of got swallowed into the culture. Not whole hog, but it was enough to cause trouble. And so then we decided we're going to start having kids. And I told him, let's get you pregnant. And then when you come home after you have the baby, you'll never have to work again. I promise. I'll find a way. And she hasn't. It's not always been easy. And it's not always been pretty, but we've managed to do it. And so that is the framing is about having children. We've had 8, 1 died. We've had 4 boys, 4 girls. We've been poor, not poor, poor, not poor again. Finally, not poor again after almost like filing bankruptcy about 6 years ago. We've done attachment parenting stuff. We've been the overbearing parents that are like trying to make their kids into little geniuses by the time they're 3 or 4. Then we've recognized like, oh, he can't read and he's 6.5 or 7. It's not a big deal. He'll catch on. And then they do, right? We've kind of gone, we've done a little bit of everything, and we've watched these kind of trends of here's the exact right way to do it. And that you see these young families out of their sort of anxiety and nervousness of screwing their kids up, especially if you didn't grow up in a good home. Emily's home was much more functional. She grew up in a Roman Catholic home. Her parents did get a divorce her senior year, and that disturbed a lot of things. My home was very dysfunctional, but neither of us grew up in a Protestant home where we were being discipled to live for the glory of God. And so this is a first generation sort of undertaking for us. And we thought, you know, there's so many trends out there that get you all stirred up. There's so many people that are clueless and don't know how to do this. How about we just do a podcast where instead of us being the heroes and know everything, we'll just tell you, here's what we've learned. Here's how we stumbled. Here's what we know scripture says, and frame it that way to be much more helpful to take some of the pressure off people. And, you know, you start one way and you end another, and hopefully the way you end is much wiser. And I knew everything about a lot of stuff that I don't know about anymore because I recognized I'm not, you know, there's a lot of freedom and liberty in how we go about living out biblical principles. So we wanted to anchor that and help build up these households.
Is there a particular place where you want people to go in order to immediately get that? I've got a few thoughts I want to jump in off of that, but make sure you just share exactly where you want people to go for that.
WeMadePeople.com. WeMadePeople.com. That's their Substack. There's a bunch of articles there. The intro episode's up there under the podcast tab. You can listen to it there. And new episodes will start coming out to the public in about 2 weeks. If you subscribe for $5 a month, you can get it all early and you'll get other stuff. But the way we do subscriber stuff is like you just get early access and you get to support us, and everything will be free eventually. But if you want to help out, that's how you can do that. And we just want to be a blessing and help people.
Yeah. You know, we ask for support all the time for the podcast. And I think people now just truly understand that when you're creating content, you just need an army of supporters who say, yeah, we support that content. And then you can keep doing that. And so everybody, you know, make sure you do go over there and look at We Made People by Michael and Emily. And then also, you know, just a plug for our stuff. We need support and donations all the time. So go to libertycoalitioncanada.com/donate. When you donate there for our shows, the donation actually goes directly to christianweek.org. because ChristianWeek.org as a charity is helping us produce our podcast. So please make sure you go do that. Michael, I think it's such an important work and you're gifted for it. You're pithy. So like you're funny and you're pointed. Like you do come up with really crafty, bizarre ways of saying things that immediately crystallize it for people. But something I've appreciated as I've gotten to know you is also just that reality, like in the trailer, what a great thing for It's Good to Be a Man trailer at the very end, where you say, you know, is everybody as bad as I am at this? You know, it's a reality that people just, you know, I say to homeschoolers all the time, new homeschoolers who you can just see them. They're just there. They got deer in the headlights. They've come to a conference and they're just so anxious. I just always say, the more you do it, the less you care. The more you do it, the less you care. Why? Because you're doing the right thing. And when you're doing the right thing, you know, there's a lot of lanes on that narrow road. Like it's still a narrow road. You're still pointing them towards kingdom values, towards the King of Kings. You're still calling them to Christ every single day. You're treating them like little pagans that you are trying to evangelize and train up. But when you're on that right path, you care, you learn to care so little about what the world cares about. It's that principle, you know, seek first the kingdom of God and these things will be added to you. You just realize that if you get you get character nailed, you get a student who will be honest with you. You get a young human who will be honest with you. That honesty is going to go 100-fold beyond, you know, a 4.0 GPA with a kid who will just lie to your face about everything, or a kid who's going to use AI to get good grades. Like you just know. So you care less the more you're doing it, because you realize how flip-flop the world has its priorities. And so I think it's fantastic that you guys are doing it in that voice. Like, okay, so we tried this and now we're doing this. And we learned this, and this is what God's word says about it. So many people need that pressure valve released while at the same time being called to a greater calling. Absolutely. So I think that's going to be an exciting journey for people to watch you on. Okay, so let's wrap things up. We talked a lot about the family. What do you want to talk about? Like if you had a bomb and you're – your new friend Michael Thiessen's over, and it's like, okay, we could light that fuse, and I want to have a fun for 10 minutes. What would you do?
Well, I think the thing I think about a lot is I am concerned about repeating. So I feel like we're having these. So in that movie, the Matrix movie, like the sequel, I think it was. At the very end of it, you find out that Neo actually has been created a bunch of times, and Neo is part of the program. So for the program to exist, Neo has to rise up, lead a rebellion. They fail and it starts over again. And it turns out there's been like 1,000. This has happened like 1,000 times or whatever.
Yeah.
And I feel like what we've been watching happen in evangelicalism probably since the '80s, but maybe a little later, maybe the '90s, but probably since the '80s, is this sort of cycle of new leaders raising up, being like changers, and then getting swallowed into the fame and the money that comes. So like guys like me didn't have much of a platform that many years ago. I've been this way for my entire life. Like I've been talking about sexuality and patriarchy and all this sort of stuff since I'm 19 years old. This is just who I am and what I'm interested in and the sort of stuff I talk about. And I've been into church planning since I was about 19. Now I have this platform all of a sudden where my problem is I don't have enough time to take advantage of all the opportunities that come my way, some which are big. And I've like canceled 12 conferences, turned down, I don't know, like 15 or 20. You know, I just really don't have the time for it right now with my responsibilities. Then people notice me and take pictures and stuff with me at the airport. Like it's happening all the time. It's like crazy. And because I feel like this is nuts. It's only 30,000 people on Twitter. But I guess that's all it takes to be someone today. But here's my point. Like, we have to break the chain of celebrity Christendom at some point. We have to break the chain of the cycle of needing to loving the money and the attention. And one thing that I'm really thinking about is how can I do that? How can I help other people do that? I don't want to. So I think about the emerging church, which was like a thing for like a couple years in the 2000s.
Oh, dude, I'm just waiting to give you example after example. Let's talk about the emergent church. Let's talk about Willow Creek. Let's talk about Exponential. Let's talk about Tim Keller
Driscoll
becoming
was
the product.
Driscoll was the new version of what's the guy was at Willow Creek? What was that guy's name?
Yeah, Bill Hybels. Yeah,
Bill Hybels.
Yeah,
he was the new Bill Hybels. And but I didn't know that because I wasn't around for the rise of Bill Hybels. And then now I'm old enough. I look back and I'm like, oh wow, these guys really mirror each other in a whole lot of ways. And now that I'm in my 40s, I'm seeing things in my 20s happen again. They're cycling out. And so I was telling a friend, like, look, people don't understand my motivations. I don't want to be the successor to Big Eva. I want to burn it to the ground, right? I mean to destroy it. Like, I'm its enemy. I don't like it. I think it's corrupted. I'm for evangelical, right? The concept of you need to have faith and trust in the gospel, right? Our ministry should be evangelical. Anytime you add an ism to something, you're talking about a system. And evangelicalism is this corrupt culture that started with good ends in minds back in the 20s and 30s, but it really is kind of just a marketing machine. And so that's one thing that's really on my mind right now, where I could lean into this and become something bigger, but it just cost me my soul. That's all. Just my soul and my integrity. So how do we reach people, but also not play into the money marketing machine that can come your way? That's so for me, bivocationalism plays a big part in that. I just don't need their money. I don't care. You know, I can't be bought. I already have my own. I have my own source. I don't even need the church to pay me if they don't. They couldn't. I'd be fine. I don't need any of it. That's why it's like the only reason I'm doing the whole $5 bit for the podcast and stuff is just like, well, it does take time and money, and it's nice to be able to pay someone else to do the editing. And then Emily and I can, you know, go out and buy a couple bottles of wine and have dinners, make more. No, we're done. I think, that's right. Like, sis, see what could happen. But the thing is, I watch what's happening right now and our ability to fleece the flock. I hate that we're monetizing fatherlessness and we're monetizing friendlessness and loneliness, that we're saying, I'll be your father from a distance if you pay me this amount of money. And of course you can't be that. So I remember I was listening to this sitcom some years ago that was kind of evil. And a big part of the sitcom was the friends kind of bicker and insult each other. And I was like, why am I so drawn to this? And I was, it was a really lonely moment in my ministry. I was like in my mid 20s and I recognized like, these guys just remind me of my friends, right? I'm just listening to it. And I think when you listen to talk radio, a lot of times, you know, this kind of jabber on about nonsense. And to a guy like me, like, just give me the content. Like, let's hear the interview. Let's hear the thing. But the thing is, a lot of people want to hear them jabber on because it makes them feel like they're part of a conversation. Makes them feel like they have friends.
Well, and truly, it is a conversation like that. So one of the things that's drawn me to long form podcasting is when you say something that I wasn't ready for you to say, and then I have to react to you, and I'm. Am I thinking, okay, what scripture should I think of? You know, did Michael just say something wrong? Did he say something good? How do I follow up? And that's like a normal conversation. And I think that's why it's a powerful medium. But I think you hit it on the head with the tension that I'm feeling. And that is, how do you influence and not lose your soul? And here's my answer to you. I've actually only seen like weirdo pastors do this well. And when I say weirdos, I mean like guys who truly love the local church and have like good kids. I know that's, but not cool kids, not into it kids, not modern kids, but you know, the image that's coming to my mind is the guy who is, he'll probably wear a suit when he preaches, and I don't love it. His kids will probably be a little bit more formal than I personally would want my kids to be. There's a family role there. I can't remember who wrote the book, The Church Went to Market.
I don't know,
but the author of that book and I see that book in like just an older white church building with, you know, some of the tradition to it. So I guess I'm just saying the guys who tend to be just a little bit more traditional and you go, well, that's just not going to help you be brandable or marketable.
Yeah.
I see those guys thrive in this world, and I don't know if it's because the way that God's built them, it forces them into a bit of a mold where they can't get beyond that. But I'm learning to respect it a lot more. I'm learning to respect the men who are strong and content and really are focusing on the home. The flip side of it is though, how do you get those type of men to be able to influence broadly? Because, you know, as you know, Tim Tyso, my other co-podcaster on our other podcast, the other club, Tim and I talked about institutional entropy. Like it is the pragmatist. It is the, I will sell my soul for the organization type of individual who moves up the ladder. Because they show their loyalty to the institution. It was those during COVID who would say, you know, you tell me to say whatever you want me to say. I will do zero research. I will give zero thought. You just, what is the label? What are we saying right now? And those people excelled in virtually every organization on earth. So it's hard because when you're trying to build some institutional strength, or you're trying to influence institutions, it's often the Christian family that is at home busy being a Christian family that doesn't get completely involved there. That's where I feel the most amount of tension. I kind of dedicated myself to never reading a Tim Keller book in my life because I didn't want to repeat the cycle. Like, I'm just going to read dead guys. If you're not dead, I'm not going to read you anymore. I've since broken that rule. Not that I've been reading Keller at all. I still have never read a Tim Keller book. And I'm quite proud of it because I didn't want to give in to that new evangelical pope who was a Presbyterian. I'm not even Presbyterian, so why would I make him my pope? Like, that didn't make any sense. But we are at a moment where we do need cultural influencers. And so for me, it's not, I'm not worried about you losing your soul, because I'm glad you're worried about losing your soul and you're going to be mindful of it. How do you balance then, though, continuing to be an influencer in such a moment when we don't need the pragmatists and the ambitious ones to just rise up and keep the cycle going? Like, how do we break the cycle but still have influence? That's something that's a real worthwhile conversation. I think you're onto something with the way that you and your family are and the way that you keep saying no to stuff. I think you're onto that. And
I meant to lose a bunch of weight, which I have since, but I meant to lose a bunch of weight before doing the It's Good to Be a Man documentary, you know, because people are like regaining a value of the body. So they're getting really into getting in shape and stuff, which is good. But I knew that would be like something I'd have to hear about. And I have. So, what I thought about when I didn't get that done, I have some severe health problems that I struggle with that I've got more or less under control at this point. So I'll get real sick and we'll gain weight just because I just lack discipline and I don't feel good. But I was kind of glad it happened. I'm glad that it wasn't perfect. I'm glad that I'm a bad hero. And when you see all these people present perfection, which is so many Instagram influencers, like I listen to these people give all this advice online and then I know their families and I've been on the phone with them when their marriages are like falling apart, like just weeks ago. And then they're online telling people how to have a good marriage. I'm like, so I think one way to do it is just to be very real. To be at peace with yourself, to be secure that, you know, God loves you and he's forgiven you and you don't like me. That's okay. Like someone said, what do you do when someone disapproves of your online ministry or someone disapproves of your ministry? And then I say, well, like in real life, he's like, well, no, when you get online criticism, I was like, I just ignore them. What do I care? Like, I've been ordained, I've been installed, I've been approved, I've been examined, I have elders. If I'm doing something wrong, people in real life will tell me and I'll listen to them. But people online, who cares? Why do you care what these people think, man? And so I think this sort of confidence mixed with being, I hate this word, but authentic, just being real, and just not needing, not being tempted by it. I was telling someone this, like, this is really hard for God to understand this. I was like, but if a beautiful naked woman knocked at my door and opened the door and asked me to sleep with her, I would slam the door shut. Like, and he thought that was weakness. Like, I'm happy. I have a happy marriage. I love my wife. Like,
sorry, what was the alternative he was looking for?
Well, I think the idea is that a virile man would jump on that opportunity, but actually a virile man, this wasn't a believer, but a virile man has control. And I think a lot of guys don't know because they just grew up giving into porn so much. They don't know you can have that sort of like satisfaction in life, right? I don't need it, right? Like I don't have
okay,
to.
Okay, so here's where I thought you were going with that.
Yeah.
Where from the Christian vantage point, instead of just slamming the door shut, it would be a Christian man could welcome her in and maybe get her a t-shirt and talk her through. And there's not that like definitive clear, because you're talking about being authentic and clear. So one of the things about being authentic as a man is you can be tempted by sexuality and you have to do your very best and you have to try your hardest to not flirt with that. And you know, when you do flirt with it, you repent of it and you have accountability in real life. But if a naked girl shows up at your door, you slam the door shut and you go to your wife and say, I don't know if there's a mental case out there, but yeah. some of y'all women need to go deal with that and help her out. It's completely unrealistic for me to continue to flirt in that situation. So I thought where you were going was this whole idea of, you know, this false image of a man not being able to be decisive and at sometimes so clear that he shocks the people around him, which is I think vitally important. And I think towards the point that you are making.
Yeah. I mean, if she got dumped off by an abusive person and she needed a blanket or something, we'll give her I'll have my wife give her a blanket. So, but I'm just saying my point I was trying to make to this guy is like, everyone thinks what they, you have to understand the opportunity that sometimes that's before you that you think you want is destruction, right? That's the woman, the seductive woman there, her way leads down to Sheol, down to death, right? You got Tobiah and Sanballat saying to Nehemiah, oh, come on, let's get together, let's talk. And Nehemiah's like, I'm doing stuff for the Lord. That's okay. Not every opportunity. And they meant to kill him, right? They meant to kill him. And not every opportunity, every invite is honest. It's certainly not good. I think once you're really busy building something and you have to decide, like, if you build an online ministry, maybe you'll be one of those guys that are around for 2 decades. But usually your flavor of the month lasts a couple years, and then you kind of ride the wave of something that makes you really big, and then you're trying to recapture that, and you kind of become sad and pathetic, and you become one of those older guys that you made fun of when you were on the way up, and then you become the oppressed becomes the oppressor, right? These guys repeat things, and that's just something that's kind of weighs on my mind these days. I'm not really interested in doing that, in recreating all that stuff. I'm interested in breaking it. I'm going to use influence because God, like I told a good friend of mine, I told Joel Webbin this actually, I just said, look, if I could just have influence without fame, that's where it's at. And that's the thing that I'd be most interested in. And I was reading about this Hollywood fixer. It was this article, and this guy, anytime someone in Hollywood has like a problem, like a studio or an actor or whatever, something's not going right, this guy's built this huge network and connection, and they call this guy in and he gets it done. And he's fixed so many things. He's helped so many stars. And to me, like, I like that. That sounds cool. Sounds like you get to have influence. You get to be involved. You get to do things, but you're kind of always behind the scenes. And I think that's, if I could go back and choose a different life, I think that's something more behind the scenes is what I would choose. But this is the path
that the
Lord.
Well, on that point though, Michael, that's really what, that's really the kind of guy that I had in mind, not the weird Hollywood, probably fix really corrupt things fixer.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah.
But the father of the family who's serious about fixing the issues of his children and setting them up for a great future. The local church pastor who's serious about working with people so that, ironically, those people do have a tremendous amount of influence, even though no one will ever hear of them. That's the way the Lord has set up the local church. And yes. So we really need godly people to do that. And then I think you're on your way with the influence thing. There is this cultural moment, and hopefully we're going to be able to do some influencing. But the self-regulation, that self-discipline, like you just said, to know that some people like me now, no one's going to, what is that? What is that verse from Ecclesiastes about, no one remembers you when you're dead, and even if you are, I'm paraphrasing here. Even if you are famous, you're 2 generations away, no one remembers you. Like it's like, you go to people today and ask them who's Martin Luther, and there's like 150 of us on the earth who remember him, and everybody else just is like, oh, you mean Martin Luther King, or and that memory's already fading. So yeah, to have a real understanding of the weakness and the vaporous nature of fame is a really good thing to have. So Michael, thank you for the time coming on the podcast. We really hope that the documentary goes well and the new initiative with the website also goes well. Mike's found on Twitter at This Is Foster.
That's right.
Again, a really crafty way of saying things. I don't know how you came up with that one. That was kind of fun. But
that's how I used to answer my phone that way. This is Foster. There you go.
This is Foster.
So
that's great.
Everything in my life just kind of flows out of just stuff happening. You know,
I feel like you and I could have a whole lot of fun if we envisioned ourselves as Italian godfathers and just coming up with different ways to treat people. I feel like if we had an evening of trying to figure that out, that would be a whole lot of fun. Anyways, everybody, thank you for listening. And Michael, may the Lord bless you and put his favor upon your ministry and East River Church up there in Batavia. And everybody, please give this a 5-star rating, share this around so that people can hear more about these resources, and Godspeed to you.